It's Friday, March 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Islamic State's second-in-command is believed to have been killed. Brussels police have sealed off an area where a suspect in this week's bomb attacks was reportedly arrested. A terrorism expert gives his analysis of Belgium's predicament.
I think what the mistake that the Belgian service have done is that it doesn't have enough human sources, infiltrators within these environments.
And a comic book exhibition in London shows the evolution of Batman and Superman. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter said Friday a top Islamic State commander is believed to have been killed in a raid in Syria. Abd al-Rahman Mustafa al-Kaduli, also known as Haji Imam, described as the group's second-in-command, was killed on Thursday, and that's according to U.S. media reports. Joining me on the line is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, who attended the press conference where the announcement was made. Carla, Mr. Carter said he could not elaborate on details of the raid, but what is known about the circumstances?
Well, they're trying to keep the circumstances very hush-hush. There's a lot of different speculation as to why, but right now he would not go into saying whether or not Haji Iman was killed in Syria or Iraq. This could possibly have something to do with future operations that are underway. But we do know that this guy was the finance minister for Islamic State. He was responsible for the terror group's external affairs, and I was speaking with a U.S. defense official who, again, would not tell me exactly where he was killed or how he was killed, but went on to say that we, the U.S. military, has seen this guy connected to direct finance operations outside of Syria and Iraq, meaning he was funding foreign fighters who are trying to plan attacks like what we have seen in a Paris or a Brussels recently.
So how will this affect, you know, going forward, how could this affect the Islamic State?
Well, this was a significant blow. Of course, it's just one man. You know, you have to take everything into perspective, but this guy was in charge of the finances. And the United States military has spent a lot of effort targeting the finances of the Islamic State. They've been hitting some of these oil refineries in the Deir ez-Zor region of Syria. They also targeted this week, they said, a guy named Abu Sera. He was responsible for paying the fighters in Iraq, and a U.S. defense official told me that he was killed in Iraq in a drone strike. Secretary Carter earlier today would not tell me exactly where he was killed either. He was trying to keep the circumstances quiet, but I did confirm that he was killed in Iraq in a drone strike. So this is several examples of senior leaders that are being systematically taken out, as Secretary Carter said, systematically eliminating Islamic State's cabinet.
Yes, I noticed when he said that. I mean, this seems to be the strategy.
Yes, it's a multifaceted strategy, as General Dunford was telling me also in the briefing. He says, you know, this is part of our plan. We are taking out the leaders, but we are also supporting the local forces. And he went and talked about what was going on in Iraq right now with Makmur. The Iraqi forces and some of the Kurdish Peshmerga have been moving forward toward Mosul. Mosul is still several weeks away before they can get there, but they've been making these initial steps, and the U.S. Marines are nearby. They're providing support for the base, and they're also even extending some of that fire support to these people advancing. And a lot of the reporters, like myself, have been questioning, is this adding more to our strategy? Is the United States doing combat operations now instead of just defensive? And they said, no, this is still considered behind enemy lines. There's no U.S. forces in combat in the front lines. They're sticking back, but they are going to provide more and more support in any way possible.
Thanks very much, Carla. That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Well, I'm joined now by VOA National Security correspondent Jeff Selden. Well, I asked Carla this, but what does this mean now to the Islamic State?
Well, obviously, as Carla said, it is a significant blow. Whenever you take out a top leader of any organization, the U.S. has seen this before, it does, you eliminate experience, you eliminate expertise. And while groups like Islamic State have been very adept at replacing these leaders, it takes time, and you can't always regain that level of expertise as quickly as a group like Islamic State would need, especially given that most military and intelligence officials say the evidence is they are under increasing pressure on the ground right now in Iraq and Syria. The other thing that jumps out is the timing of this, just a few days after the attacks on Brussels, which most intelligence officials were saying represents a propaganda victory for the Islamic State, where they've been able to shift the focus from Iraq and Syria, where they've been losing ground, to Europe, where they've been able to strike and get quite a bit of notoriety. It's interesting that this announcement comes just a few days later saying, look, the Islamic State is striking in Europe, the U.S. is saying, because they are losing in Iraq and Syria. They're losing hold of their caliphate. And not only that, even though they were able to pull off one attack, their leadership is disappearing, and that's because of what the U.S. is doing.
Now, Secretary Carter did not want to go into specifics about the circumstances of the attack. How do you see that?
It's interesting. It's interesting, and it leaves lots of room for speculation. Often in the past, when there's been a decapitation strike of sorts where the U.S. coalition forces go after a leader and it's been an airstrike or a drone strike, usually they come out pretty quickly and say that. The fact that they did not say that leaves open lots of questions. Was this a ground force? Was this a ground operation? Remember, there was another leader taken that they took out. They tried to capture, but took out the oil minister several months ago, Abu Sayyaf, and they had a team that went in to Syria and tried to grab him. It leaves open a lot of questions. Was this a similar type of operation that was underway?
All right. Thanks very much, Jeff. That's VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Well, joining me on the line is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Andrew, what's happening?
Well, there's a lot of reaction to this ISIS leader, the second in command, being killed, and a lot of people sharing those clips from that press conference with Secretary Ash Carter, with Secretary of State John Kerry, and saying that this is kind of a psychological victory for maybe the people of Belgium, that after this attack, now that they've struck back against ISIS. But I've also seen people sharing photos now saying, you can't stop Brussels, you can't stop Belgium, you can't stop our people, and they're showing scenes of them out at bars and trying to get back to their normal lives. So trying to be defiant in that way and share that message on social media.
What else is trending?
Well, we have some political, of course, political, because everything that Donald Trump does seems to trend in one way or another. And in this case, it's a photo that he put up of Ted Cruz's wife, Heidi, compared to his wife, Melania, and saying the photos speak 1,000 words. Of course, he picked a very beautiful photo of his wife and a very unflattering photo of Ted Cruz's wife. So a lot of people striking out on social media saying this is not how politics should be. It's reached a new low. Also trending today, rumors of extramarital affairs that Ted Cruz may have had, people spreading those rumors, Cruz supporters accusing the Trump camp of spreading those, and again saying that this is dirty politics, we've reached a new low, the Trump camp saying it's all fair game. So a lot of back and forth, as we're seeing on social media, and a lot of rumor and kind of tabloid speculation. But again, that resounding kind of sentiment is really this is where our political state has gone to this, and people are not happy about that.
Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute.
Music has the power to transcend barriers of language and culture and the ability to stir deep human emotion. A group of Finnish researchers has found that it's not only the music itself, but also where you listen to it that can influence its emotional impact. Previous scientific research suggests that emotional reaction to music can be gauged by physical responses, such as changes in the electrical properties of the skin. With this in mind, the researchers played a selection of a Beethoven symphony as it would be heard in different concert halls to a group of test subjects. The scientists from Aalto University attached sensors to the subjects' fingers, which measured these electrical changes as they listened to the music under the varied acoustic conditions. The researchers found that music played in the acoustical environment of shoebox type or rectangular concert halls produced the strongest emotional reaction in the listeners than other hall designs. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, an exhibit in London pays tribute to comic books. Police Police in Brussels sealed off an area in the suburb of Schaarbeek Friday, where a suspect in this week's bomb attacks and a foiled plot in Paris was reportedly arrested. Reporters at the scene say explosions and gunshots were heard during the operation. They report a man was seen lying on the ground being questioned by police. An officer in bomb disposal gear was also seen in the area. Schaarbeek is the neighborhood where police found an apartment filled with explosives and other equipment following the Brussels airport and metro attacks on Tuesday. Well, Magnus Ranstorp heads terrorism research at the Swedish Defense University in Stockholm. I asked him about the criticism of Belgian authorities for perceived security lapses, with more evidence of links between the Paris attacks in November and this week's strikes in Brussels.
I think Belgium is in a tough spot. It has a federal system with lots of bureaucracy. You have six different police districts just in Brussels. You have different administrative units trying to coordinate, which is not easy. They have been focusing on the issue, but they're a relatively small security service. They have 470 foreign fighters that have gone off to Syria, some have come back. Their geographic position also means that there is an operational belt of extremists stretching from Molenbeek to Paris, which switches back and forth. We've seen that the weapons in Charlie Hebdo came from Belgium. The Thalys high-speed train attacker came from Verviers in eastern Belgium. You know, so sometimes they plan and operate across borders, and maybe there is not enough coordination between the French intelligence, which is a huge service, and the smaller Belgian ones. I think also the Belgians are, should we say, handicapped by the fact that Belgium is also the transit point for trafficking in human beings and drugs and weapons. So you have everything. It's a cocktail of lots of different issues and problems. So I think to that extent, it's a very difficult environment to police. I think what the mistake that the Belgian service have done is that it doesn't have enough human sources, infiltrators within these environments. It's also compounded by the fact that they have not enough prevention efforts, so they only rely on repression, police intelligence. And if that's not bad enough, the terrorists themselves have moved towards encryption in their communication, which makes some of the security services half blind in trying to follow the different connections. So I think it's sort of like a perfect storm of different weather fronts that come together that had made Belgium so vulnerable.
Looking at the security situation for Europe and certainly North America and other parts of the world in general, looking at these attacks, you know, how in the future do you think authorities can try to prevent this by places like airports and subway systems?
Well, the UK have been dealing with this, of course, for a long time. There are technologies that can be used in terms of at least explosives to be able to detect the explosives being brought down into the subway systems, etc. So there are technical solutions. You can also move out the perimeter. You also need to have some personnel that is ready to be able to, if there is an active shooter, to take them on very quickly. I think it depends. I think, you know, it always begins within the nation state. So what they need to do is to, first of all, invest in adequate security resources for the intelligence and security personnel. They simply are, for example, in Belgium, there isn't enough of them. There also needs to be greater cooperation, particularly bilaterally between different countries, to be able to follow some of these networks. But there are larger issues as well. The issue of identity theft is a huge one. For example, there are 177,000 Swedish passports on the loose, either stolen or lost. There are 400,000 German ID documents and passports that are on the loose as well. So getting greater biometrics, also, of course, passenger national or name records needs to be focused in on. That's a huge issue they're discussing in the EU and the Brussels. It is compounded by the fact of the refugee issue of vetting people. Do we know who they are? Of course, there are very small numbers only who would maybe have an extremist or terrorist connection, but we also need to have those systems. We also need to tackle the trafficking in illegal weapons, the Balkans is one area where there's a lot of activity on this front. So there's a lot of different areas where there's a great need for improvement.
Magnus Ranstorp, he heads terrorism research at the Swedish Defense University. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. The new movie Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, has two of the comic world's heroes facing off in an epic conflict. International Edition's David Byrd tells us that a rare collection of the original comic books that gave birth to the characters is on display in London.
If the name Ayman al-Hariri sounds familiar, it should. He is the billionaire son of assassinated former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik al-Hariri. He is also the owner of The Impossible Collection, featuring first editions of Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman comics. Some of the books are valued at $1 million each. Each of the clear displays in the exhibit features the comics behind special protective cases arranged like shelves in order to show them off. There are special lights to showcase the comics without damaging them. Visitors can look at Detective Comics number 27, the first time Batman appeared, or Sensation Comic number 1, the first cover of Wonder Woman. There is also a 1938 copy of the first issue of Action Comics, which featured the first appearance of Superman. Less than 100 of the comics exist in the world, and Hariri has two of them. The billionaire construction magnate says he is not worried about his collection being exposed to the public.
I think people have a respect for these books and the characters that they represent. I really wanted the design of the display to allow people to get as close as possible to them.
Many of the original issues came out just before World War II, when the world was still struggling in the Depression and the Nazis were rising to power in Germany. Hariri says that the artwork and even the ads in the books show people the turbulent times.
To really see just what the world was like at that time when the book came out, each book has a very good representation of what was going on in the world at the time. So I wanted that to be clear. And even the ads are amazing on the back. They're fantastic.
The 37-year-old Hariri says that he has been collecting the books for 16 years since he was 11. He kept the comics in boxes and did not get to see them in their entirety. Hariri says that he was especially drawn to the Superman comics after seeing an illustration of his late father.
When I went back home after not being there for a while, I noticed a picture of my father drawn as Superman. It's actually in the gallery here. And he's carrying schools and universities above the torn Lebanon below him.
Ayman al-Hariri says after his father's death, he collected as many Superman books as he could get his hands on. He says of all the heroes featured in the exhibit, his father is his greatest hero because in real life he chose to do good things. The Impossible Collection is open at London's St. Pancras Hotel and features more than 1,000 original comics from Hariri's collection. The billionaire businessman says he wants to share his collection with the world, But for now, the exhibit is not traveling. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thanks very much, David. That sounds like a very interesting exhibit. Well, we mentioned earlier in the show about political news, and this sort of goes along with that. U.S. President Barack Obama is coming under criticism for dancing the tango and attending a baseball game during his tour of Latin America this week. Now, that occurred while Belgium continues to reel from the deadly terror attack. Mr. Obama was on the final day of a groundbreaking trip aimed at normalizing relations with Cuba when Islamic State suicide bombers attacked the Brussels metro and airport, killing at least 31 people. Rather than cut short his trip, Mr. Obama pressed on. He delivered a speech to the Cuban people and later sat through three innings of a baseball game in Havana, where he laughed and even did the wave with President Raul Castro. The next evening, during a state dinner with Argentine President Mauricio Macri, the President and First Lady Michelle Obama were reluctantly led onto the dance floor by a pair of professional tango dancers who had been hired for entertainment. Well, that's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns in the strongest possible terms the outrageous terrorist attacks in Israel and Jerusalem, which tragically took the life of American Taylor Allen Force and left many others severely injured. Mr. Force, a U.S. veteran who had served tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, was stabbed by a Palestinian on the Jaffa boardwalk by the Mediterranean. The last 5 months have seen a spate of Palestinian attacks on Israeli civilians and security forces. These attacks have consisted mainly of stabbings, but also shootings and car rammings. On a recent visit to Israel, Vice President Joe Biden denounced those in the international community and in the Palestinian Authority who have failed to condemn Palestinian terrorist attacks against Israel. Let me say in no uncertain terms, the U.S. condemns these acts and condemns the failure to condemn these acts. He also said the rhetoric that incites that violence, the retribution that it generates, has to stop. Such violence cannot be accepted, said Vice President Biden. This cannot be viewed by civilized leaders as an appropriate way to behave. It is just not tolerable in the 21st century. Palestinian terrorists are targeting innocent civilians, mothers, pregnant women, grandfathers, and American citizens, said Vice President Biden. There can be no justification for this violence. The U.S. stands firmly behind Israel's right to defend itself, said Vice President Biden. U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby said, "We continue to encourage all parties to take affirmative steps to reduce tensions and restore calm."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials. We'll be right back.
Bend.